Okay, we're good to go. And first of all, I want to welcome everyone back and thank Define Health for an excellent program. And the last session was also terrific as it brought up many of the issues that we want to discuss. My name is Jeremy Goldberg. I'll be moderating the panel on moving beyond mutations to key drivers from sequence to function to decision. And we have a terrific group of panelists here. What we're going to do is I'm going to cover a few introductory slides to address some of the topics, and then each of the panelists will briefly introduce themselves in context of several of their presentations, so you'll get to hear from each of them. We have both experts on developing drugs as well as some of the new techniques and technologies that could address some of the issues with dealing with mutations. So first of all, we heard in the earlier panel some of the challenges with conventional targeted therapy, that there's inherent heterogeneity and diversity. This is from a Newman Journal of Medicine article a couple years ago, and we heard a lot about some of the challenges that creates for targeted therapy drugs. And we also know now that cancer cells are highly mutated. This just shows that even though we know some of the best-known driver mutations, the KRASs, the EGFRs, there are clearly many more of those, and there's such a frequent mutation rate across a range of tumors, as you see here on the x-axis, that we clearly don't have all of the driver mutations identified yet that we need to really understand phenotypically. And we're beginning to get approaches, this is from a recent Nature Review article, to more functionally characterize the cancer genome, everything from where it exists in terms of hypoxia versus cell cycle versus metastasis to different phenotypic and other approaches to understand the cancer genome. And this is just one example of many systematic analysis of somatic mutations in phosphorylation signaling to predict novel cancer drivers. Not perfect. Lots of challenges of signal to noise because there's lots and lots of new data here. It's hard to interpret. But this is one example of trying to understand more about what the drivers could be. And here are some questions we will address during the course of this panel. There's tremendous amounts of information now, and sequencing means more and more DNA mutations available, but that doesn't give us the deep level of understanding we need. There are some new kinds of predictive models, new platforms we're going to just hear about in a minute that could help with hypothesis testing, but we still are not addressing the driver mutations are not equating to the best targets, and the predictive biomarkers are not yet addressing key issues like heterogeneity of tumors. So with that as some of the backdrop, we'll come back to these. I'm going to ask one of our panelists, Dr. Jeff Settleman from Genentech, to start the discussion.
Yeah. Great, thanks. Great, so let me just briefly introduce myself. Jeff Settleman from Genentech, where I'm Senior Director of Discovery Oncology. This is a group that oversees both discovery and validation of oncology targets, and we also support the discovery of predictive biomarkers for our oncology portfolio programs. So I want to start just by emphasizing some things that we've already heard, we're familiar with. This paradigm, of course, of personalized cancer medicine, I think, has been highly enabled by, among other things, the oncogene addiction paradigm, particularly in the context of kinase inhibitors. And this is where I think we've learned a lot about both the value, the importance of being able to use genomic information to drive treatment decisions and to effectively develop new agents. This notion that mutationally activated kinases define states of vulnerability in cancers. But at the same time, what we've also come to appreciate are the challenges around not only biomarker discovery, but also assay development and implementation in clinical trial schemes, and then in real-world practice. So challenges at every level. One aspect that I want to particularly emphasize as I just walk you through a few of what I see are the key challenges in discovery and clinical translation of predictive biomarkers for oncology is illustrated here. And that is that in these two examples of, very successful discovery and development of predictive biomarkers in the context of, crizotinib treatment of ALK-translocated lung cancer and vemurafenib treatment of BRAF mutant melanoma, what you can see here is while there's, you know, remarkable efficacy across the diagnostic positive patients, it's really a continuum of response, and that, you know, what we're not so good at is predicting which patients will do very well, which patients will do somewhat benefit, and which patients won't respond at all. And, you know, I think what we appreciate is a couple key things with respect to this spectrum of response. And those are that, first of all, tumors are heterogeneous, and I want to emphasize that. And in a couple slides, we'll talk a little bit more about that. But also there are probably other contributing mutations, and I think we know that it's not simply a case of biomarkers in this setting being binary indicators of response or non-response. So just in terms of, you know, what's required to go from the discovery of a predictive biomarker for what appears to be a validated oncology target and a good molecule to inhibit that target, what's required when we think about discovering predictive biomarkers and translating them and implementing them in clinical practice at every level, starting with preclinical studies leading to hypothesis generation, developing appropriate assays. Usually that's followed by some retrospective testing in a clinical trial setting, prospective screening studies, regulatory approval, and then real-world implementation. And at every level, I think, you know, we see a variety of challenges. We've already heard about a number of these here, of course. One of these is the use of non-representative preclinical model systems. I think this could be particularly problematic in the context of cancer immunotherapy. Despite all the excitement there, we still, as we heard yesterday, are struggling with, you know, the systems that will be ideal for discovering predictive biomarkers, because we really just don't have great preclinical models that capture the biology of the human disease in the context of how the immune system engages the tumor. Technology-related issues, of course, I think we're going to hear a little bit about those and how they impact our ability to detect biomarkers, you know, specifically measuring analytes accurately. Biospecimen-related issues, of course, this plagues us and will for some time. Until perhaps we find paradigms for using liquid biopsies more effectively, for example. But obviously insufficient samples is an important issue. Inconsistencies in how samples are prepared and stored, specimen size, heterogeneity, as I'll come back to again, within the tumor, and just the availability of tissue in the clinical trial setting. Clinical studies, of course, need to be sized in such a way that they can be statistically powered for both for hypothesis testing and for discovery, perhaps, of unexpected biomarker findings in clinical trials. The alignment of drug and companion diagnostic development timelines is something that we may not all be thinking about, but this is a real world issue. I think that you know, the companion diagnostic development actually takes longer than I think many of us had appreciated when we sort of went down this road. And, you know, as we have more experience now, recognizing that really getting a jump on a companion diagnostic, which of course means that one needs to have good data to support that in order to invest in a great, you know, a powerful assay that can be used clinically in a robust way. And this is expensive, so the cost of companion diagnostic development is significant. There are obviously the regulatory hurdles and insurance reimbursement issues to consider as well. But the issue that I mostly wanted to focus on is intratumor heterogeneity, and both in the context of course, multiple lesions within an individual patient, but also as we've come to appreciate the tumor heterogeneity that exists within a single lesion. And, you know, we hear a lot about, or we see a lot of descriptions of tumors that look like this, where mutations are reported as binary events. They're there or they're not there. But I think we all appreciate that they are going to be, you know, they're not necessarily going to be homogeneous in the context of a whole tumor, but rather they may be present in a subset of cells. And they may, in fact, coexist in some cells with other lesions, and in some clones within the tumor, they may not even exist. And yet, when we, the way we're currently measuring, genomic-based, sort of mutationally-based biomarkers in tumors, we're generally scoring them as yes or no. And I think this is a bit of an issue where we're going to need greater both depth of sequencing analysis in order to really understand the representation of mutant alleles within a tumor. But even more importantly, perhaps, will be what to define what's going on within individual cells within a tumor. And that's illustrated here. To sort of make this into a simple sort of hypothetical case scenario where you have two different melanomas that are both scored as mutated for BRAF and P10 in this case. Now, if we just, in other words, we measure a biopsy from these two tumors and we find evidence of BRAF and P10 mutations, so they're scored as such. However, there's something very different going on in these two tumors, which we wouldn't be able to know unless we look at them in a different way. In one case, tumor one, these mutations are actually in two different cells within this tumor, two different clones. And in a second case, they're both within the same cell. Now, this becomes important for a number of reasons, one of which is a very practical reason with respect to how this tumor is treated. One can think about, in the case in tumor one, one could think about sequential treatment, for example, with inhibitors of the BRAF pathway or the PI3 kinase pathway, where perhaps combining those treatments leads to a certain degree of toxicity and therefore limits our ability to really suppress those pathways efficiently at the same time. But we may not need to do that in tumor one. Perhaps, since we're dealing with two different cell populations, one could think about sequential therapy there. Whereas in tumor two, sequential therapy probably wouldn't do anything if these tumor cells within this tumor are heavily reliant on both of these pathways to sustain their survival, we would need to be combining these treatments. So this is just a simplified view of, I think, a really broad problem that we need to address probably at the level of single cell analysis, perhaps with the use of liquid biopsies, if we can achieve the depth of coverage in sequencing data to reveal these contexts. So I just want to highlight that as one of the key challenges, and I think that's where I wanted to end there.
Thank you, Dr. Selman. Very helpful way of describing some of the issues. We're going to switch now to a couple of technology approaches, starting with Rob Buchanan-Peck in terms of some of the biomarker approaches.
Thank you very much. My name is Rob Ruitenbeek. I'm head of R&D at PemGene in the Netherlands, which is a functional biomarker company. I'd like to share some slides with you. Well, this slide has been shown just a minute ago, which shows clearly that there are so many mutations. What you see on the y-axis is the number of mutations per megabase. So it's not per tumor, it's per megabase. So you can multiply this by 3,000. It means that on the upper right side, melanoma, there are hundreds up to thousands mutations per tumor. So we've been talking today and yesterday about actionable mutations. What is actionable about hundreds to thousands of mutations? So it was also mentioned this morning by Linda Chen that the genotype is not the phenotype. So we need more platforms. We need alternatives to DNA profiling, which is a very powerful method in itself, of course, but we need more information. What this in this paper has been shown by the Singer Institute is that you can regard those mutations as a kind of fingerprints, kind of signatures. And if you use these signatures, you see overlaps maybe between prostate cancer and colon cancer. But let's move on to the next slide. Just this picture, which is an old picture, of course, but the caterpillar and the butterfly, they share exactly the same DNA. So if the caterpillar is the responder in a trial and the butterfly is the non-responder in the trial, then solely looking at the DNA, that's insufficient. Doesn't tell the whole story. As we all know, that if there's a mutation in DNA, it doesn't mean it's in a gene that's expressed as an RNA. If the RNA is there, it doesn't mean it's expressed as a protein. The concordance is very poor, it's very low. If the protein's there, it doesn't mean it's active. And if it's active, it doesn't mean it can be inhibited by the drug. So it might be interesting just to look at the activity of drug targets, the activity of the pathways in which they are involved, instead of solely focusing on DNA. It has been mentioned before, it's good to reiterate. So what we have done, together with a lot of academic collaborators, is we've developed a method to look at this activity of drug targets. We started with kinases, we're now moving into phosphatase because they play an important role in the immune response. We take sample from the patient, we extract the proteins, and analyze the activity in such a sample. For example, a biopsy, as you can see here, we just take the biopsy, extract the proteins, put it on a chip, a biochip, a peptide microarray, and using the peptides, we can detect whether there's activity, whether it's lots of activity, whether it's high or low activity in the patient-derived sample. But as we're looking at activity, it's a functional proteomics approach, we can also add drug, so we can add the drug in the test. And if we have pre-dose samples, this means we can generate drug-specific information. Before the patient put onto a drug, we have samples, but they have never seen the drug. So to generate drug-specific information, that increases the chance of identifying biomarkers that predict the response of the drug, not of the drug target, of the drug itself. So that's what you see over here. We analyze those activities, and in the presence of the drug, we see reduced activity in case of responders and non-reduced activity in case of non-responders. And focusing on the non-responders is very important because the response is often driven by resistance pathways. But very often we do not know up front what these resistance pathways are, and how they are alike. So now we've started in the Netherlands a couple of trials in which patients, for example, in breast cancer, are fully sequenced on 400 genes, so the complete panel. And from that, we check whether it's actionable or not by using this activity-based approach, this kinase profiling, kinomics, in which we include also the drug. So we're going to check whether these DNA mutations, whether they are in an active pathway, and whether they are inhibitable or not. We have applied this in a couple of studies, very small studies, in non-small cell lung cancer, identifying Tarceva responders, in the LARC, locally advanced rectal carcinoma, identifying chemo radiation responders, and also melanoma for BRAF mutated patients to respond to fimaravenib. So we can separate those patients based on this approach, at least in these small studies we've applied. We identify which pathways are active, and we can also generate more information, for example, focusing here on the non-responders, the non-responding patients to, this was a renal cell carcinoma trial, non-responders to sunitinib. What you see here is the blue patients, they are the responders to sunitinib, of the blue patient, this is a dose response curve in a single patient. The green are non-responder, and we see also on the chip exactly the same. In this kinase assay, the responders respond, the non-responders do not respond to adding the drug on the chip. But what happens if we now test another drug, like erlotinib in this case? Now we see the opposite. So apparently in the non-responder, there's a high EGFR, or HER-like kinase activity, which can be inhibited by erlotinib. So this generates immediately the hypothesis that maybe those patients should be treated with an EGFR inhibitor. And of course, well, we have all those inhibitors available. We can test axitinib, crenolinib, crizotinib, etc., etc. So now we have started to generate, well, not phenotypic, but a higher level of information besides the DNA mutations in patient-derived samples using the drug. So we like to call this pharmacological profiling, and that could add to the whole plethora of possibilities which are available. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Breitenbach. Very nice presentation. Next, we're going to have Ronnie Morris from Champions Oncology talk a little bit about some of the other approaches, such as patient-derived xenografts.
Thanks, Jeremy. So I'm the president of Champions Oncology. what we do is we primarily work with the patient-derived xenograft model, which is taking the patient's tumor. Usually these are fairly advanced stage patients who have seen multiple drugs beforehand, taking their tumor, putting it into an immunocompromised of the mouse model, and building that model, and then taking different drugs and testing against that model to see what's going to be most efficacious for the patient. We do this as a service to oncologists and to patients, and we've implanted about 800 patients to date just in the personalized oncology services. We also work with a lot of academic institutions. We have a lot of tumor model research collaborations and do a lot of research with academic institutions. So our history to date is we've implanted many, many more than the 800, but we've worked with about 800 patients to try to get their oncologists and the patients a better answer. The fundamental issue that I think we're trying to solve is when a patient goes into a trial or a patient goes and gets any single drug, and then we take that data, which we've all heard about the challenges of the data, but let's assume that we are able to capture all of that data. One of the challenges is you only get one piece of information at one time, and then the patient moves on. You can't assess what would have happened if you gave a combination to that patient. What would have happened if you gave a different drug? How does this one drug match against another drug? And in order to do those type of trials, you need incredible amounts of money, incredible amount of time, incredible amount of effort, and it's just not getting done. In a world where there weren't that many drugs, that might have been okay and feasible. But in an era now where we have so much more information, we have an explosion of information in terms of the genomic, and it's not only the mutations we're getting today, but now it's the RNA as you've heard, and it's the epigenetic information. How do you put it all together, and how do you build all these hypotheses? How do you treat many targets at one time, and how do you do those trials in a cost-efficient way? It almost seems impossible. So what we've done is we've looked at the PDX model. It's not a perfect model. It's not like having the patient, but it has a tremendous amount of accuracy and the validity. We have looked at the first 100 patients, the correlation in the clinic to the correlation in the PDX model, and we have correlative rates in the high 80% range, and that's after time, because it takes many months for this PDX model to for us to make the model and generate the model and test the model. If we go back and look at the treatment the patient got right after the PDX model was established, the rates are even higher. They're in the high 90%. So it has a tremendous amount of the fidelity. Obviously, over time, the patient's tumor changes, the mutations drift, and the efficacy of the model begins to wane. So we primarily, what we do is primarily are looking to understand cancer and understand all the interactions and be able to look at simultaneous response data. We see our technology and the way the pharmaceutical companies are currently using our technology. They're using it to simulate trials. A couple of years ago, they were using it for mechanisms of action. They were looking at it as a preclinical checkbox to see if this drug worked or not. Now they're actually taking 50, 100 models, and they're testing different hypotheses to see, before I take it to clinical trials, how can I do more hypothesis testing inside the PDX, inside these patient avatars, before I have to get. We have a lot of anecdotes, and we're currently, doing a whole bunch of different trials with different academic institutions. But we see many times where patients have multiple the mutations. We had a patient who had a MDM2, CDK4, a JAK2, an FGFR. He was given a CDK4 inhibitor, a JAK2 inhibitor. Didn't help in the PDX. It didn't help in the patient. He was finally given Regorafenib and actually went into a complete CR. You just can't do that for every patient in the clinic. You really need a model, and this is not what we're finding is it's not a great of a diagnostic. I'm not envisioning tens of thousands of patients developing PDX models, what we're really using this is as more of a playground for cancer discovery, drug discovery, the biomarker discovery, to be able to take large cohorts of patients, build a PDX, be able to say, okay, we have a cohort of 15 or 20 patients who had a great response, a cohort of 100 patients who didn't have a good response. Let's retest these patients, because you can't go back to the clinic and retest a patient, but we can go back and retest the PDX. Let's go back and test these patients. Let's see, could we have done better for this tumor? Can we understand this cancer, but this particular tumor better, with all the heterogeneity that we see in these PDX models? Can we go back and see, was there a better combination for this tumor? We finally understand this tumor. Let's go on to the next tumor. Let's go on to the next tumor. And eventually, our ultimate goal is to do this for 5,000, 10,000 tumors, so we can start to understand some of these interplays and some of these questions that we're all asking that is very hard to answer in the environment that we're in.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Morris. We're going to have Bob Cohen from Calico talk a little bit, picking up on Dr. Settleman's question about heterogeneity, and then Dr. Lengauer. But if you have questions, please start thinking about them. So after these two next talks, we'd like to get some of your feedback. So, Dr. Cohen.
Excuse me. To my way of excuse me. This is an amazing discussion to be having, at least for me, because in 1996, I found myself leading the Herceptin project at Genentech. And as all of you know now, that's a drug that has a companion diagnostic, and in fact, some of us would say it was the first companion diagnostic, at least in oncology. And the questions and the furious arguments that bedeviled our development effort at that time have largely been resolved. And we've given ourselves no credit for that, I'm afraid. So back then, what people argued about endlessly, for example, was whether fish was better than IHC. Turns out not to be an important question. They're both good. They both predict responses. That was one analyte, one thing we were trying to measure to predict which patients or to decide which patients should get Herceptin. We now understand that deciding which patients get Herceptin on that basis has tremendous predictive value. And, you know, mindful of the discussions about the expense of treatment, this has now become a standard. We don't acknowledge it, but it's true. We're almost demanding that our drugs work because they're so damn expensive. We ought to demand that they work. And so this kind of diagnostic work is important. Now, I would say now it's almost 20 years later. And we stand on the threshold of having almost unlimited information to bear on the same questions. But now the questions are much broader. We don't have the, you know, Herceptin, HER2, it doesn't get any easier, right? Once we move past the point at which we recognize that this was a unique tumor, that's been demonstrated by every analysis that's been done since. Yesterday we were speaking to the breast cancer classification. HER2 positive breast cancer emerges naturally out of an interrogation of messenger RNA. That was known in 2000. I believe that's the case for almost all of the cancers that we've been discussing. The problem is we don't know the drivers. We don't know what to look for, and we don't know how to look for it. So, you know, how to move forward from here. The first thing I would say is anecdotes are interesting, but they're anecdotes. How much can you learn from somebody's story? We need principles here. We need to generalize what we're doing. And I would argue that we have a decision to make, because as we were just shown, if you genotype tumors and consider the genotype a kind of phenotype, at some level, every patient is their own unique tumor. You know, somebody talked about 1,000 kinds of breast cancer. I would argue that the mutational sets tell you that every tumor is unique. And if that's the case, then the principles we need to work on are, what is a tumor driver? What is an actionable mutation? We throw the words around, but I'm afraid that we don't really know what they mean. And then the last point I would just like to say here, and maybe we'll come back to it, is we have talked for 2 days about heterogeneity, and we haven't described it. We've just talked about it. What does it mean? Jeff showed a slide showing two different kinds of heterogeneity, two different subclones in a tumor versus a tumor with multiple mutations. As Jeff said, those lead to different, should lead to different treatment paradigms. And in general, we don't know which is which. And so with regard to heterogeneity, I just want to make the point. When I was in the lab 20 years ago at Genentech, this was a philosophical question, whether tumors were heterogeneous and how heterogeneous they might be. We now have at our disposal tools that readily tell us that. If you sequence deeply, you can describe heterogeneity really well. And the question that I would ask is heterogeneity per se a predictor of bad outcome? I'm not even sure that's been asked in that way. And so one thing I would urge, besides the hunt, which we're all engaged in, for cancer drivers and actionable mutations, I think we need to move on to a better description of tumors in terms of their heterogeneity in particular, so that we can classify them. Because as I said, I really don't think that there's much value in anecdotes. There's a little more value in lumping things together. And if we're really to learn how to take care of patients, we're going to have to begin to group what are clearly unique tumors into buckets that we begin to understand. We heard in the last panel that that's ongoing, and I think that that's really laudable, but I think we have a very long way to go. One other brief point to make, a place where I think this has been applied really well, is adenocarcinoma of unknown primary. When I was a fellow, that was an endless hunt for the tissue of origin, which failed about two-thirds of the time, and then you just gave whatever you thought might work, and then when that didn't work, you were in trouble. I think now with a recent work from Foundation and other places, I think you begin to fractionate cancer of unknown primary by the mutations that you see. Now, whether those are really driving mutations, that remains to be seen. But at the very least, we have a basis for classification, and we begin then to have a basis for rational therapy. And I really would like to see our field move from what I think are the paradigms of the last century to the paradigms of the new century.
Very good. Thank you very much, Dr. Cohen. Dr. Lingo?
Yeah, I'm Christoph Lingo. I'm the CSO of Blueprint Medicines, and Blueprint Medicines makes highly selective, exquisitely selective kinase inhibitor medicines for patients with genomically defined diseases. And I really liked what Bob was just talking about, because he talked about sort of the new paradigms, and I maybe want to cover five mindset questions or concept questions real quick that potentially you can take back into your community or in your company. The first one is the blueprint, the underlying fingerprint of cancer is understood. We don't really know yet what to do with it, really, but in principle, we are done. And that work has been done in most of it in the academic setting. I remember when I was at Johns Hopkins, I worked for 12 years together with Bert Wulst in a molecular genetics lab at Hopkins. When we sequenced the first, cancer genome, and then the first 98 cancer genomes, we were so excited. And it was so expensive, and it took us so long. And today it's very, very easy. But that effort of understanding the genome was an academic effort. And that brings me to the first point, is how can we leverage in the future the academic resources and talents for drug discovery or for helping patients in a better way in the future. I tell you, it's not drug discovery itself. We need to find a way, again, to engage them, whatever that means. That's number one. Number two is unmet medical need. I hate this term of little unmet medical need. Take metastatic melanoma as an example. We are talking about, we don't have to engage in this anymore. How many companies will now work in metastatic melanoma because, like, immunotherapy, we are done? A friend of mine, Michael, he just died of melanoma. He was 52 years old. He leaves a wife behind and two little children. Or take head and neck cancer. which company is actually actively working on head and neck cancer medicines. We're trying to understand the underlying cause of head and neck cancer. It's too small, it's complicated. A friend of mine, Pat, 32 years old, his tumor just recurred after cisplatin and radiation therapy. He's 32 years old, there's very little hope. Or take patients with hepatocellular carcinoma. If you live a year longer after diagnosis and sorafenib treatment, you belong to the lucky group. Because that's the extensive, that's the right end of that curve. There's no approved second line. Who is working on HCC in our companies? The third point is there has been incredible success. And we as a community should be proud of that. And that's so spectacular and it's so important. And a lot of that success are medicines against drivers of disease that are mutated in cancer. BRAF, KIT, BCR-ABL, CDK4, ALK, BTK, HER2, EGFR, the list goes on and on. This is important. I think we shouldn't forget that and get too sophisticated in our heroic efforts to understand everything. The fourth point is I found it interesting. There's kind of not a criticism, just an observation. There's no session at this meeting on diagnosis or early diagnosis. And my wish is that next year maybe we have a session that sort of addresses this topic. We know that the best way of helping patients is to diagnose their tumors early, especially in a pre-malignant setting. And we as an industry or as a community are not doing a great job in that. I remember when my lab developed a liquid biopsy, that what excited us was that potential to actually diagnose patients early. And I think we have not enough efforts in that space. And the last point has to do with rare. Bob Orb just mentioned that also, and I think it's super, super important. Cancer is an accumulation of rare genetic diseases. And we better get used to that. And I see this in interaction with big companies, and I was at a big company, two big companies before us. We have still a lot to learn in that mindset. The discovery organizations tend to understand that. Development organizations don't know how to deal with it. And the business units deny that fact. We cannot continue to work that way. If you take, and I'm not talking only about sort of, you know, stratifying patients. I'm also talking about the rare cancers per se. If you take the cancers that have an incidence of less than 6 per 100,000 per year, that group of cancers would constitute 22% of all cancers. That's bigger than any common cancer per itself. Where's our effort to understanding those diseases and work towards that? And of course, in reality, it gets worse. I think we better get used to the fact that we need to find treatment options for patient populations that are only between maybe 500 and 5,000 patients. And I think there's a sort of a change of paradigm that's necessary, and we need to have sort of the guts to sort of work towards that patient population and that medical need as well.
Well, we've covered a tremendous amount of topics. Thank you very much. Are there questions from the audience now before we switch to some of the key questions we want to address? Yeah.
I just want to make one observation. We ran that panel on early diagnosis 3 years ago at this meeting, and nobody showed up.
Okay. Other questions? Dr. Rolf.
Yeah, just a couple of comments and a question. One for Bob. I think probably the first companion diagnostic was the estrogen receptor.
Fair enough. Although we didn't call it that at the time.
Sure. And yesterday's discussion around B cells, and Dr. Settleman today mentioning oncogene addiction, we haven't really talked about non-oncogene addiction. BTK is not an active mutation. It's the biology of the B cell, and likewise for PI3K delta. All our early chemotherapeutics target non-oncogene addictions that we can somehow separate with a narrow therapeutic index. So I'd like perhaps folks to think about that. And the third question is, with all the mutations that are out there, how do we frame, from a computational perspective, the notion that low penetrance, multiple mutations give a phenotype? How can we possibly address that problem? Because one driver gives you a very varied response, and maybe it's a combination of low penetrance, other mutations that are defining the biology.
Who would like to address that?
I could say one thing in response to the last thing you said. And I don't know I don't think anybody knows the answer to that. But I think in my plea to turn anecdotes into principles, I think that we should be looking at those cases, collecting them, trying to find some stylized therapies for them rather than unique one-off therapies for them so that we understand exactly what you just asked for. What do low penetrance summation type mutations mean? If we had a bunch of people who had something that we recognized as similar, and you could actually take them to trial and learn something about their responses, I think you really can move forward. I mean, you could short circuit that maybe using the kind of PDX kind of things that were just talked about. But my answer to that is, got to do trials. Can't just guess. And I think that's the problem with so-called, you know, drivers, is that you're really just guessing.
Yeah, maybe I can add something. I think we somehow get lost, and maybe it has to do with our obsession that we think now we need to stratify. And of course that's important, that we need to stratify patients, but I'm not sure it's the right approach from a mindset point of view, because that implies that there's a big patient population out there and we need to sort of find now the individual responders. Conceptually that's correct, but like methodologically it's convoluted, because the real situation is the following. Every patient's cancer is different. Therefore, the real responder group is one. And now we need to find a way, and that's towards you, your point, Bob. Now we need to find a way of make this patient population bigger, because we can't make drugs for N of ones. And there we need to simplify in a different way. We need to simplify by sort of finding commonalities among a patient population that's bigger than one. Mm-hmm. To say, what are the 50 patients or the 200 patients with those three or five changes that still were to respond in that setting which I abstracted in an N of one? And I think if we approach it that way and run our trials that way, that potentially makes us more successful.
I had one point to the also with respect to your last question about the large number of maybe low frequency mutations. So within an individual tumor, while there may be hundreds or thousands of mutations, of course, what's quite difficult to do beyond counting them is understanding which of those are even functional, have functional consequences. That could, as opposed to which ones are simply passengers. One way to begin to address that, maybe at the level of this heterogeneity issue and understanding heterogeneity in depth by looking at single cells within a tumor, because I think we'd probably all agree that if we found that there were certain mutations that were present in every cell in the tumor, those would become the place where we would focus. We would want to understand whether those are functionally contributing, and if so, are they defining a new target or perhaps a target that we already knew about, but that they are likely to be more relevant than mutations that arose at some point during the clonal evolution of the tumor, in which case, if they're present in 10% of the cells, even if we understood how to target them and thought they might be contributing, we're still only dealing with 10% of the tumor in that case, at best. So that's just another way to think about the importance of in-depth analysis of the heterogeneity in trying to make some sense of this, really complex mutational landscape that's been described in most cancers.
I want to pick up on this and ask Rob, because you're doing biomarker work. We all recognize that there's this tremendous heterogeneity within cancers. We all recognize also, as Dr. Settleman said earlier, that we need companion diagnostics, or else the payer's not going to reimburse for a new $100,000 a year drugs. So how do you balance the fact that you need something consistently to indicate that this is the right drug for this patient, given the fact that the heterogeneity means you really don't ever know?
I think it's a very extremely difficult question. However, there are some technological possibilities, like laser microdissection, which is something we apply. Because of the method we have developed, it's an enzymatic readout, so you can you need only very small tissue samples. But it's a difficult one, and I don't know the answer.
If you compare cancer to sort of a trying to win a war. If you were to analyze a war zone by understanding every single detail and every person involved and everything and how they think and where they are and what they do and like every single weapon and whatever, you will not get anywhere. But if you try to figure out, tactically what are key sort of moments where you can interfere, you can start trying to win that war.
Maybe that relates a little bit to my remark that we can sequence the whole genome of each patient. We know every mutation. But in the end, what is a relevant mutation? What is really driving the activity of such a tumor? And what we often see is that some tumors have very, very high signaling going on. We don't know exactly which pathway is involved. But then using the mutation information, we can maybe figure out which is relevant, link that to the drug available, and approach it a little bit more pragmatically, because I think also many wars are won just pragmatically.
Well, let me ask the once and future Genentech team. So you have the one example from the past of HER2 new, which was clear, and is incredibly useful. And then you have Dr. Settleman's comment about today the companion diagnostics take a lot longer, much tougher. So how much data do you need to say that's a good enough companion diagnostic to take that product in the clinic and move that one through as the signifier for our drug? Want to start?
Yeah. Well, obviously, with data, the more the better. That's the simple answer.
Right.
When do you reach a point of confidence about taking a companion diagnostic forward? That's really, so far and is small, and it's really been case by case with different experience as we go. I think, the less than satisfying answer will be that we're still learning about when we have enough data to have the confidence to take a companion diagnostic forward. And given that we do a lot of companion diagnostic assay development work essentially at risk, we invest at risk early because of these timelines and because of the uncertainty that can play out, all the way into a phase 3 study. We just don't really have the luxury of time to wait until we have, really robust data sets in order to move forward on a companion diagnostic strategy.
I think that's an excellent question. And I heard, at the previous panel or sometime in the last couple of days, somebody said that maybe companion diagnostics should just fade away. And I agree with that. I think companion diagnostics have always been a halfway technology. They're dedicated to a single drug. And one of the big challenges to that is I imagine myself taking care of patients, having to being confronted by a list of potential tests that I have to think through as I think through my therapeutic opportunities to treat a patient. And that makes no sense to me, and it never did. My view is that companion diagnostics are really and should be thought of as a tool for drug development. And what I would like to think is that drug companies could work through what they think they're going to need in the clinic eventually, work it through in drug development, have an open discussion with the FDA about how you're going to morph from a test like that dedicated to your own drug development to a valid test that may already be on the market. We discussed yesterday analytical validity and clinical validity as the basis for some of the diagnostics that we use, and I think that's exactly right. I think that, for example, the foundation approach of rounding up as many mutations as you can get under the lamppost at once makes some sense, because a lot of companion diagnostics that are being developed now will map onto one or another of the genes that are being interrogated in those panels. To me, that it would be a big step forward, and an even bigger step would be to agree as a community on what a reasonably comprehensive and yet manageable in cost set of diagnostics would be on every patient. I mean, if we're really to make sense, for example, of unusual responders, we could do that prospectively if we would just collect a little more information in a stylized way across the universe of patients that we see. So that would be my answer. I look forward to the day when companion diagnostics per se are a thing of the past.
Any comments from the audience or over here? Questions?
So I'm just going to make a comment. So Bob gave a great example, Herceptin as a companion diagnostic, but in many ways I think it shows the limitations as well. And the discussion we are having is completely focused, tumors, mutations, lots of different collections. That's the easy part of companion diagnostics, because we know that, and there's a reason why most of the diagnostic tests we have worked through so far, they're either right at the level of the target or one step upstream, downstream. So Herceptin, we can say, is a great drug. Bob and I were together involved, so I'm not saying anything he doesn't know. The fact is Herceptin works really great for 20% people, reasonably good for another 30%, another 30% no benefit. So I think we really have to evolve this debate of companion diagnostics beyond the immediate target. And a very practical example is when we started developing Perjeta, knowing HER2 status didn't help us a whole lot. The fact is we still don't know which patients benefit from Perjeta or Herceptin after Genentech and us had spent tens of millions of dollars, and yet it's a great drug. So, and to sort of Christoph's analogy of the army and battle, I think what we are doing is we are sort of taking one attack on the enemy, but as the enemy adapts, we are not actually looking at how the enemy is adapting. So I don't really see a way forward beyond immediate target unless we really devote the effort and energy into real-time dynamic understanding of tumors after we give the drug to the patient, because that's where all the action is.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's, as both of you said, it's very important to get this information. And this is where genomics efforts like Foundation Medicine or many others are powerful. And it's so hypocritical to have a discussion about should it be approved or reimbursed or whatever. It's, come on, I mean, as people are dying and we need the information. Who cares if this is 98% right or 97% right? It doesn't matter. And I think there we need to totally rethink that, not only on a regulatory side, but also on the big pharma side, where we're far too conservative to constantly save our position, to be safer, and to be, you know, just to not working.
Let me circle back to Dr. Morris. One of the potential ways of addressing the confusion on mutations is to have better predictive models. So what data are you generating with your patient-derived xenografts to give you more confidence that you've got better information going into the clinic?
It certainly helps individual patients. Right now, it's been helping individual patients, but I don't think that that's the place for the PDX modeling. I think the place for PDX modeling is for drug development, and the discovery of drugs. Because at the end of the day, it isn't about the amount of data, it's about the right data. And the right data we need is the simultaneous response data. We need to know which drugs are going to work in which patients and for how long. Is it going to be 5 months or 8 months or a year, or is this going to be a complete response which is going to put a patient into remission? You know, it's just once the patient moves on, the patient moves on. We need a way to capture that data. It would be great if we could continue to follow that patient, but it just doesn't work. So we have to have some, and whether it's organoids or PDX models or some other type of data, we have to find a way, because there's too much information, there's too many choices right now. We have to find a way to be able to have some other way besides the patient to figure this out. And what we're working with our pharma and other academic partners is in using PDXs to be able to develop a lot of these hypotheses.
And may I ask, you mentioned the tumoroids. What is the big difference between the tumoroid approach and the PDX?
I'm not an expert in organoids, so I can't.
So in the Netherlands, we're now applying this with Professor Klevers. It's being applied and implemented, but it's very difficult, isn't it? You mentioned already that it's
right.
For PDX to get it into standard practice will maybe not happen. Or?
Both of these approaches are very difficult. They're very cumbersome and expensive, and there's a lot of work that needs to be done. But it's just another approach.
Question for Dr. Lengard. Do you want to talk a little bit in terms of how you think about the number of driver mutations you need to know to run a program?
You know, one if it's a good one. If you have it hardwired, like in KIT and CHIST, you need nothing else. Now, there are settings where you need more, and some of you in the audience brought it up, and we have to do good combinations. I personally happen to believe that we should combine highly selective drugs rather than making promiscuous compounds because of overlapping toxicity and because we want to hit the individual targets as hard as we can, EGFR being one good example.
Question, Bill. Forget it.
But how do you think you can help us as clinicians? I don't know that you necessarily have to push each drug to its maximum tolerated dose in combination. And I think that and I may be, you know, smoking dope out in left field, but I'm thinking that predicated on what the profile of the molecular signature is, you're going to eventually need different ratios of drug combinations predicated on what you have molecularly. Can you comment on that?
No, I agree. How do we approach that? I think we need to... Now, remember, there used to be this term, clinical research. And now what I'm trying to say is we are not doing much clinical research anymore. If you look at it from it, when you do and several others do, and I think, you know, the academics and the clinicians do, but when you look at it from a pharmaceutical company point of view, we are sort of very conservative towards that as well. I think, you know, I think some of the most creative trials are ISTs, are the trials that, you know, investigators drive because they think about it and take a risk and they try things out. And they have the big premise of learning from that experience. That's what clinical research is. Rather than that obsession of getting that drug approved, I think we need to learn more at times, and that's why I admire sort of the investigator-driven trials, and that's where I think, you know, that's super, super important. And that's where we can ask those questions.
Question in the back.
Hi, I'm here from Seattle, where we've been talking a lot about drug approval, and a particular drug, marijuana, was approved there for legal use with everybody. So we're smoking a lot of dope out in left field there. So this is, you know, more of a provocation than anything. You know, we're here to talk about going beyond the mutations, but we're still just talking about driver mutations here. Companion diagnostics, let's just put more driver mutations into a single panel and call that a companion diagnostic, even though it's for many different drugs. But what can we do that really goes beyond that? And we've talked a lot about biology in the B-cell malignancies that matter beyond driver mutations, and it seems like there's there's tools that we need to bring to bear that'll take us beyond these driver mutations to really the pathway biology of the disease that I think we all believe in. And just love to hear your thoughts on that.
Can I comment on that?
Please.
I mean, I think it's a great question and something I think about a lot, because I think in response to what, you know, Christoph, you were just saying, if you have one great driver, that's what you need. And while that's true to some degree, I mean, we're not really talking about curative therapies in any of these discussions. We've kind of unfortunately set a relatively low bar for declaring victory. And even in the case where we have a driver, a well-validated driver mutation, and an exquisitely selective drug, we're still not curing patients. And that's probably because even in a case where the tumor is genomically completely homogeneous with respect to that driver mutation, because it was an early event, maybe it was the first event, who knows, that there are non-genetic determinants of heterogeneity within populations. I think we're increasingly coming to appreciate that. It's a much more difficult problem to understand mechanistically. In my group, in my lab, we model this and try to understand it, and we think we have some clues about how cells switch between phenotypic states, even with the same genome at an epigenetic level, and how they switch between states that have dramatic impact on the response, the sensitivity to a single drug that will affect a large percentage of the cells and still leave other cells untouched because they've just become phenotypically distinct. A good example of this is the epithelial mesenchymal transition, and we've seen in clinical practice with EGFR-targeted therapies, I think some of the best data on this, where you can clearly see the selection for a more mesenchymal population still harbors the EGFR mutation, but for reasons that are not well understood, is refractory to the effects of EGFR inhibitors. So how do we deal with that? Well, one way is, and it's happening, is to characterize not only the genome but the epigenome of tumors. And I would say not just at the whole tissue level, but, you know, again, at the single cell level, we really have to be, to study heterogeneity in a meaningful way, we have to be looking at the single cell level, because ultimately that's the target of all these drugs we're throwing at the tumor, is each individual cell. And we need to know what's going on. Now, this is obviously quite challenging. It's not going to happen overnight, but I think this is an important consideration.
Bob, you had a comment?
Yeah, I think that's really a good question. And if I understood it correctly, it even went beyond heterogeneity. What you're asking about is, and beyond drivers, of course, what is the hardwiring about particular cells gone cancerous that can be exploited? And I think that that's really where, as Christoph pointed out, discovery biology is really at the core of that. That answer is not coming from sequencing mutations. But I'll give you three examples where I think we've actually gotten to good places. So three different ones. So BTK, not usually a target of mutation, although clearly a target of treatment-induced mutation, which is the holy grail. That tells you you're onto something important. Androgen receptor in prostate cancer, right? Finally, I remember going on a diatribe at this meeting a couple of years ago, yelling at somebody for celebrating the success of abiraterone and particularly MDV-3100, which I thought was a huge miss. For 20 years, we've known that the androgen receptor was driving prostate cancer. Why did it take us so long to figure out that cells co-opt it every way they can to keep getting the signal? But we now know that that is a driver, not a mutational driver, but a driver of prostate cancer, and it begs the question of better treatment directed at the androgen receptor. And now we're living with the fruits of that. The third, and I think maybe even the most important, because I think it's the most general, are the pro-apoptotic proteins. Again, sometimes they're targets of mutations, but a lot of times they're not. And you have cells living on the edge of apoptosis, drugs like, you know, ABT-0199, you know, these are terrific drugs, and I think they're going to be broadly applicable. And what I would like to see are some broad-based combinations that include, maybe to your point, some of those kind of treatments as a backbone. And then on top of that, maybe you address yourself to drivers. And that leads me to another point I just wanted. I won't go on a diatribe quite as much. I don't think any of us should be in the business of single-agent therapy. We're dealing with cancer. Darwin was right 150 years ago. Nobody should be happy about on-target resistance developing from single-agent treatment. That is a mistake, and we should get past it by using combinations that matter.
Question, Dr. Rolf.
I'm glad you brought it back to combinations, Bob. So another comment. I think as a community, we don't do well at defining an optimal dose for many of our new agents. Great example, 2 weeks ago, carfilzomib beat bortezomib in a head-to-head. They used twice the approved dose. I don't know how they're going to get on with that. So it's just a plea to, and there are many, many examples, I think, to Christoph's point, we do want to hit these targets hard, but that means really understanding what the most optimal dose is, and it's more important in combinations.
I think that's a super point. I mean, this whole question of dosing and scheduling, I think we are not addressing well. And again, it comes back to ISTs or whatever, where, you know, there are a lot of playing happens and experimental work happens, which is important. But we are not. We're going in with doses that we, okay, once a day because it's convenient. Okay, really? Does it make any sense? What's the evidence for this? Dose. We go up to MTD. Sometimes that's a good idea. Sometimes that's a really bad idea, and we are not sort of exploring well what it is at half dose. Maybe there's more efficacy. We'll see some of those data coming out, especially in pancreatic cancers very, very soon.
We have time for one more question. Dr.
Gerber.
And by the way, for those who are wondering, thank you for the comment about marijuana. For those who are the munchies, there will be lunch right after that.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up again on the day yesterday, the immune oncology day that we had, and looking at the discussion we just had, driver mutation, genetic-induced cancer, I think that is what we have done in the past, and we've done some of that very well and some of them not so well, but we've seen that even if you get that mutation and you look at the waterfall plot of responses to treatment of very selective drug, not everyone responds. So we kind of know something is missing here in our game. And also we know in order to induce durable responses, targeting these genetic mutations, in most cases, not all, usually it's associated with relapse. I think the missing part we haven't discussed that in the next step, immune oncology, neoepitopes that we have seen now in the clinic can predict response, durable responses. How do we overlay this test on top of this genetic test, and how will that be happening in the future and in the interest of the patient and more durable responses?
Anyone want to take that one? Tough question.
Oh, I think it's a tough question, but I think the answer, we're living it. I think it's an empiric answer. I think we just have to overlay it and ask the question. And, you know, I think you're alluding to with immuno-oncology particularly, there's at least implicit in the approach is some sidestepping of the heterogeneity, right? That's the hope anyway. I've heard some of the people in that field make some pretty strong statements that heterogeneity doesn't matter anymore. I'm not sure that's right. It's easy to imagine escape from immunological approaches on the same basis. But I think the answer's got to be empirical by any route, PDX approaches, empirical within patients. And again, I think we could do a better job as a community collecting our experience and laying it bare in a transparent way so that we can get quickly to the right answers.
Okay, I'd like to thank our panelists for a terrific session.